Accession number 13572, Reel 2.
Well, I was on 78 of a bloke called Bunclark, Bunny Bunclark. When I got to the squadron, he was just finishing his first tour, this bloke. And October, he was one of the first to go to Rickle, which was the first con unit in Paul Group. And he was instructing there. And come 43, Tate had gone, Cheshire and Warner. Warner was 78 Squadron CO, and a couple of flight commanders like McDonald and Neil. Neil was a New Zealander. They pop over to Rickle, you know, to see all the old instructors, you know, because they were all blokes on it, 78 or 76. And they roll up there, and what can you do with an Halifax, you know, because they roll up with a Mark II 1A Halifax, which was the last of the inline engine Halifaxes, which was far superior than the old Mark V's. Training rubbish, you know, because all the training aircraft there were all ex-squadron aircraft, all clapped out. You know, they shouldn't be flying, but they used them for training. And Bunny went over there one. Bunny was there, and he greeted him. He said, "I think I can loop the loop in an Halifax." Oh dear, oh dear. So they all laid bets, and about eight pilots got in. No engineer, no nothing. Cheshire was in it, Warner was in it, O'Neill was in it, Neil, McDonald was another flight commander on 78, they were all in it, and Bunny got it up to about 24,000, empty, because it was empty, and he looped it, he pulled out at 8,000.
All the other pilots on board?
Yeah, see, one was in the rear turret, one was in the mid-upper turret, you know, no engineers, no watts, nothing, just a load of lunatic pilot. And he looped it. He pulled out about 7,000 or 8,000 feet, see? And Carl was the AOC of four group, the Vice Marshal. He said, "The man's mad. Ground him. Don't let him anywhere near an aeroplane." A month later, Bunny was back on 78 when we were breeding squadron leader. He got the chop coming home in Berlin, I think. Yeah.
Because casualties among air gunners are pretty high, weren't they? I mean, you were the most vulnerable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they tell me there was over 28,000 got the chop.
Air gunners?
Yeah. A lot of blokes, isn't it? On my course, there was only five survived the war out of 60. And one of them, Minnie Mitchell, he was a prisoner of war for 2 years. He got the chop April 43. And we lost 55 that night, Pilsen. He was one of them. He was on my call.
Did you have to bail out at all?
I bailed out three times, but it was a course. It was a, I don't know whether it was a parachute course, I suppose you'd call it. Americans took us. But you had to pack your own chute on the last drop, free drop, and you had to pack your chute. They showed you how to do it. Mind you, I've done it about four times. You know, I'm sure I hadn't packed it right. It was a free drop out of Dakota. That was in North Africa. A lot of blokes went on that course, you know.
Why were you trained to do that? Was this a special operation or something?
Yeah, on special ops, we were on special ops then. Because me and Moran used to change places on bomber command. See, one night I'd be in the rear, the next night I'd be a mid-upper. See, and this is how we worked it, me and Liz. And when we went out east, they took the mid-upper turret off. There was no mid-upper turret. And they made a mid-upper gunner, whoever he might have been, what they called a dispatcher, which was the first of these air load masters and all them kind of, it was the forerunner of that. Well, his job was to look after parachutes, you know, because you're dropping blokes, you're dropping SAS blokes and spies and agents and all this lot. And you had to make sure that they were hooked up properly, you know. So me and Moran went and done this course, you know, we both done it. See, because we used to alternate, you know. But a lot of crews wouldn't do that. I know rear gunners who told me their mid-upper would never go in the rear. You know, mid-upper gunner, and they stay, they wouldn't do an op in the rear. I said, you're joking. He said, no. My mid-upper wouldn't go in the rear.
What, because it was more vulnerable or what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you ever hit?
Never. In the boot, but that was on Mitchell's daylight bombing. Yeah, when I finished that night bombing, I went on Mitchell's daylight bombing. So I got hit in the boot, didn't scratch the leg. Flak, you know. But it was just your luck. I think it was luck, 90% was luck.
But you still ended up at the end of your first tour of the only two gunners that survived.
Yeah.
Now, your survival, were you...
Of the nine.
Yeah. But were you continually changing crews then, or what? Or were you with the same crew all the time?
No, I flew with a load of crews. Yeah, I've done half a dozen with Ronnie Reed, flew a couple with Emmons, a couple with a bloke named Adams, done half a dozen with a squadron leader named Chappell, and I got out of his crew, I'm not having him, and what reason that I got out of Chappell's crew was coming over the North Sea, coming home, not on the turret door, opened it, it was Chappell. Get out, he said. I want to see what it's like in the rear turret. I said, who's flying this aeroplane? He said, Johnny King, the bomb aimer. I said, God, stop it. I slung the door on him. Yeah. When I got back, I said to Shorty, the gunnery leader, no more him. When I told him, he said, you're joking. I said, no. I said, no more him. He got the chop, Duisburg, in May.
But did you have much choice? I mean...
Yeah, yeah.
Could you ask to come off a certain crew?
Oh, yeah.
Join another one?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
But you had to have a reason.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't do it willy-nilly. You know, I don't like the colour of his eyes or something like that. They wouldn't have that. You know, it had to be a reason. You know, something happened like that. Had to be a good reason like that.
And it was a pilot.
Yeah. He got the chop at Dortmund. Next stop, I flew with Mills. He got the chop. Dortmund man, he lost four aircraft that night. That was May, 43. Just after Gibson done the dams, we went the next night to Dortmund. Chappell got the chop. It was over 800 aircraft on that job. And he lost four. Even one of them was Chappell.
Was there a lot of moving about between crews if people were unhappy with their skippers?
Yeah, well, not a lot, you know. I think once you've done half a dozen with a crew, you know, you were more or less settled, you know. But if something happened and you didn't like it, you could, you know, ask me to come off. I got out of about five or six crews on 78, you know, they all got the chop later on. Ronnie Reed was the original bloke I flew with. He was one of the few who finished, him and Mills.
That's how you survived.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever come off one crew only to find the next crew you got on was even worse?
No. Bloke Adams, I went to St. Nazaire with him, and he all I could hear was, put that torch out, put that light out. I thought, Christ, it was the engineer. It was their first stop as a crew. See, on 78... rear gunners and pilots did 2 second dicky trips with experienced crew. See, I had to go and do, as a mid-upper, I went as a mid-upper and done two trips. Yeah, I went down, I don't know, I went Mannheim and Turin, which is 42. Now, the pilot, Ronnie Reed, had to do 2 second trips. Now, there was no two, he just sat there, because there was no two sticks in the Halifax, there was only one control column. He just sat there and, you know, to give him experience. This is what you had to do. See? Well, when I went to Adams, this was his first trip as a skipper, you know, with his crew. Went to St. Nazaire. And all I could hear was, put that light out, you know. It was the engineer, you know, wandering about looking with a torch. Oh, Christ. And when we get over the target, this bomb aimer, Oh dear, oh dear. You know, left. I thought he was going to go round again. You know, I said, get rid of them fucking bombs. I said, never mind about anything else, you know. Let's get home. They took the only clear picture of Satan is here that night. So, you know, got the chop, second trip. Next trip, they all said, no more of them, shall we? And next trip, they bought it.
And surely, I mean, all this changing crews around, I mean, you're on an airfield, you're on a squadron. It gets round the squadron pretty quickly who it's safe to fly with and who it isn't.
Oh, well, it's...
I mean, what I'm saying is,
there was no safe.
Find himself without a crew one night because they've all got the hell out of it.
No, it never got to that stage, you know, because the chop rate was... we were losing three a night. Every night we went out.
From your squadron?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We lost 5 out of 6 at Flensburg in October 42. But those were the days when you only had about seven aircraft, you know, squadron. That's all we had in 42. You know, all this 1,000 bomber lark. We didn't have 1,000 bombers. Yeah, it was wonderful propaganda. Because in the summer of 42, we were on our arse end. We'd been beaten everywhere. I mean, the army had run away at Dunkirk, 300,000 had run away. 90,000 jacked it at Tobruk. 100,000, the little darling, surrendered Singapore against 30,000 little yellow men. See? We had nothing to shout about. We were losing ships by the dozen in the Atlantic. You know, we had nothing to shout about. And they come up with this 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne. June 42, we didn't have 1,000 bombers.
You were on it, were you?
No, wasn't on it. But we never had 1,000 bombers. Most of four group squadrons only had about 7 or 8 aircraft. If that, you know, if they could raise 6, they'd done well.
So, in fact, how many aircraft could they get into the air at one time in those days?
The first raid I ever went was 129 aeroplanes to Turin. There was only about 1 squadron or 2 squadron of Lancasters in 42. That's all we had. The rest was Wimpies and Halifaxes and Stirlings. They used a few squadrons of Stirlings. There was no Pathfinders. You know, they hadn't got it organised, really. It was that battered wanderings all over the shop, you know. I don't think their success rate was much more than about 10-15%, if that, you know, as regards effective bombing. I don't think we had more than about 10-15%, you know, until Harris took over and really got it organised, you know. And by summer of 43, you know, April 43, we'd got it down to a fine art then, by then, you know, we'd got it going. But up until then, it was hopeless. And their losses were really fantastic. You know, they were...
Fighters and anti-air.
Fighters was 90% at night. Fighters were 90%. Because you've got to bloke up your arse 100 yards away. He ain't going to miss. No matter how you... And some of their German night fighter pilots had over 100 bombers to their credit. Shot down over 100. You know, see, they didn't have, they'd leave, but they didn't have tours like we had. See, they flew until they died, or the war ended. Germans. See, this is where you had the blokes, you know, 500, 800 ops, you know. I mean, Andrew Rule did 2,000 ops. Stuka pilot, 2,000. Mainly on the Russian front. See, they flew until they died, or the war ended. As we do 30 bombing ops, you were grounded, you know, for about 6 months. Instructors.
Now, you moved on to special operations after your bombing operations over Germany. That was when, in 43?
Yeah, yeah.
And how long did that last?
Well, we finished... Breton, yeah, on 78 in July 43, and we started operating in August 43, our second tour. And we came down here to Lynham. We were at Week Lynham. We did a consumption test, which was about 10 hours. Had all the needles. We were only at Lynham Week. Flew to Urn on a Saturday and took all 6 o'clock Sunday for Gibraltar.
In Halifax?
In Halifax. And it was packed full of life lights. You know, you had life light in a May West. And this aircraft was packed full of these life lights. And we landed at Gib. And they wouldn't let us stay there. So we went on to Port Leoti, which was 20 miles from Casablanca. And it was a Yankee drone. And me and Moran were gone. That was it, ta-da. We were in Casablanca, you know. And Mills come about 2 days later and got us out of some spiel, you know. It was a kind of gambling, come brothel, come, you know, everything. Because we'd won a few cards. He got us back. And next day we flew to Ras Al Mar. It was a knitting face right in the middle of the Sahara. That was it. It was the hottest place I've ever been, you know. And when we left there, we had to be towed round by a tractor. We weren't allowed to taxi round the aircraft. This is 6 o'clock in the morning. Start your engines off, you know, because when you start your engines, you had a minute run-up of each engine. None of that. Start your engines off, take off. You're overheat the engines. We took off there and landed at Bleeder midday. You know, it took us about 4 days to get there. Bleeder.
Where is Bleeder?
30 miles from Algiers. And there was only 4 aircraft there. You know, we were the 4th. And the bloke in charge was a fellow called Austin, Squadron Leader Austin. I'll never forget him. He'd come out, he was on 138 Squadron, which was the main squadron doing all this special up lark, you know, from England. See, they used to do Northern France and Holland and Denmark and all them. And he'd come out there to organise us, you know. Well, Mills was he was a senior officer. He was only a flight lieutenant, but he was the IOS officer, because the other bloke was a flight sergeant, and the other fella was a flying officer, Canadian, and the flight sergeant was Georgie Regan, even Australian. And while this Austin was there, he was showing us, you know, what to do, you know, telling us how to work this special op lark. Another flight sergeant turned up, Colin Hine. He was a big, tall bloke, New Zealander he was. And after about 3 weeks, this Austin opted it back to England, you know, with him and his crew. And there was only us 4 there. 1575 flight, they called us, you know, and we were tucked away at the other side of Bleeder, like, you know, and the army controlled all this special op lark, and we weren't allowed to talk, and you know, and all that lark. 36 Squadron was there. They were Wimpy's, Coastal Command. Strugnell was the group captain, a bloke named Strugnell, group captain Strugnell, MC, First World War bloke, you know. And, yeah, he didn't even know what we were up to, you know, because the army, he'd been told, keep your nose out, you know. And he wasn't told for months what we were up to, you know. And from then on, well, we never got a CO till December 43. We were there 4 months before this bloke turned up, Stanbury. Then they said, your squadron. They converted us into 624 Squadron. But it was only us 4 there. And you only operated in the moon period, see? You didn't fly in dark nights, only in the moon period.
Tell me a bit, a typical special op. I mean, you'd be briefed on a drop zone, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but you were, on this lark, you were briefed individually as a crew, not a squadron. Because all the crews were going to different places. I mean, you might find yourself, you've got to sort out halfway up a mountain or some farmer's backyard or, you know, some field somewhere. So See? And there was no radar out there. It was all... You had to have a good navigator. And we had two. We had Jock Cafferty was the navigator, but Ginny Ferrell, our bomb aimer, was even American. And he joined the Canadian Air Force, you know, before the Yanks were in. Trained as a navigator, got to this country, early 42, as a navigator. Promptly put on a bomb aimer's course, because they were short of bomb aimers in those days. He then went on a shipping recognition course, 4.5 months, you know, flying about over the Scapa Flow, and, you know, so he was an expert. And he transferred just on 70, he came to 78 Squadron, and he transferred into the American Air Corps just before we went out east, you know. And we took him because our own bomb aimer was a Canadian who was on a bombing leaders course, and they wouldn't let him up the course. So, you know, in the refuel postage, you go the same day or the next day. You can't hang about for some bloke 3 or 4 weeks to finish a course. So we took Ginny Ferrell because he was another navigator, you know.
And your passengers were presumably just anonymous people, were they?
Yeah, yeah, you never knew who they were, you know. We dropped them all in, you know, English, French, you know,
Italian. Were there several at the time? Sometimes you had several?
Yeah, 6 was the most we ever dropped in Italy. We dropped all them 6. I thought they were SAS blokes, you know. But others were odd. Now and again a woman. Then one night they fixed up a kind of... it was like a telephone, really, in the aircraft. Big box it was. And... We're being briefed, and they said, we're not dropping anybody tonight, but we're taking a woman. And this woman, we went at some branch, this woman was talking to the people on the deck, you know, through this box, this kind of telephone thing. And it was all in French, so I didn't know, you know, understand what he was talking about. But when we got back, she said, they learnt more in that half hour what was going on, you know, reported them, then through the various channels that the way this information come back, you know, to our people. I used to get lectures about once every few weeks, some army major would turn up, you know, intelligence officer, and give you lectures, you know, what's going on all over the shop. He knew the names of all the German commanders, all the Russian commanders, the Japanese commanders.
His lectures what? We're talking to the people on the ground?
No, to us.
Oh, to you?
The air crew. Yeah, he'd come up and give us a lecture.
But while this woman was talking through this telephone, you were just circling
the area? Yeah, yeah, we were circling the area.
So presumably it was a very weak radio signal that could only be picked up.
Locally,
they,
yeah.
They didn't want to spread it all over the airwaves.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. We took her a couple of times, you know, then other crews took her, like, you know.
And all over the Mediterranean area, really, Italy,
yeah.
Southern France.
Yeah, France, Northern Italy, you know. We used to drop Italians into Italy. No good dropping Frenchmen into Italy. See, you dropped Italians. And the Frenchmen, you dropped them near enough the area they come from, because they got, you know, different accents like we got in England. I mean, you couldn't drop a bloke from Paris and say, round Marseille or somewhere like that. It was different, more or less language, like us and Geordies or us and the Liverpool. See?
So how long were you doing that those operations?
We finished in April 44. April, May 44. And we left the squadron in June 44. Come home. I'd done 60 then on Halifaxes.
Then what did you do?
Went up the Nan. Me and Moran and David the engineer went up the Nan. Mills and Doc and Dalt, they were Canadians. They were sent back to Canada, 2 tours. Ferrell went back to America. He'd done about a tour and a half. Jock Cafferty stayed out on 624 as the squadron navigation officer, you know, leader, squadron leader. And we went up the Nan. Me, Davey. Davey went on Transport Command, and me and Moran tried to get back on 4 Group, but they wouldn't entertain it. They, it was an aircrew assessment centre, what they called it. All aircrew, one or two tours, grounded. You had to take a ground job. And me and Liz didn't want that. So you went before a board, wing commander and two squadron leaders, all air gunners. The bloke named Snow, well named he was, White Air, he had, DFC, done a tour on Lanks. So when I walked in, we were flight sergeants then, me and Moran. So he said, what do you want to do? I said, go back on four group. I said, I refuse to fly on Lancasters. I said, they're death traps. I don't want to fly on them. And this bloke's done a tour on Lanks. I didn't know. You know, he said, why? And when I told him, he couldn't believe it. I said, you got a rear turret, Fraser Nash, useless. I said, one engine, it's worked out with one engine. I said, that engine knocked out, that turret's US. I said, your mid-upper on a Lanx is the same, that's worked out with one engine. You can come home on two, and you're defenceless. He looked, yeah. I said, they're death traps. I said, I refuse to fly them. I said, don't you send me a five group. I said, you send me back a four group. And I'm all, oh no, he said, you've done two tours on Halifaxes, you can't do no more. See, you're grounded, see. So he said, go down and see the educational officer. And this old boy, he was about 50, ex-headmaster. And when I walked in, he said, don't matter what you want to be, he said, we've got a course for it. I thought, how are we going to beat him? You know, see, so at Nairn, you were parked up a mountain, you know, it was about half a mile walk down to the sergeant's mess for breakfast. Well, me and Moran never had a breakfast there. We were there 3 weeks. We never got up early. We were going to walk right down there. So the day comes, we got to see this bloke. So I said to Liz, what are you going to tell him? He said, I'm going to tell him I'm going to desert the Air Force and join the Paris. So I thought, well, I don't know if it'll stand with that one. You know, you might have heard that one. See, what you had to do was tell them a yarn that they'd never heard. See, so we're walking down this mountain, and three blokes are walking up, and they look like tramps, because Moran said, look at them. He said, they look like tramps. And they did. See, there was only one bus from Nairn to Inverness, when at 8 o'clock in the morning, see, and one bus back at night. 5 o'clock. So if you wanted to go into Nairn at night, you had to catch that bus, otherwise you had to walk it. It was about 7 or 8 miles. See? Well, these blokes had missed the bus at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they'd walked from Nairn to our camp, which was about 6 years. Probably been on the nest all night with some bird. And so they did look well, like, you know. And before that, about 3 hours dancing, you know, this Scottish real lark, you know, they had a wooden shack in there, and that was their dance hall. God, stung me. And they never stopped, you know. And so they did look like tramps walking up there, well knackered, weren't they? See? So I said, yeah. And then, anyway, we went down this see this educational bloke. In goes Les. And when he come out, I said, what did you tell him? He said, I told him that. He said, I'm going to desert the Air Force, join the Paris. So I said, what did you say? Sure, he shook me hand. He said, congratulations. And he got posted to a Stirling mob glider towing. You want to join the Paris? You know, I'm all here. And I'm sitting outside the office, and I'm thinking, what am I going to tell this fella? And then suddenly it occurred to me, you know. So here I go. So this bloke said, all right, flight. He said, now, where do you want to be? I said, wall back. I said, a couple of weeks ago, you told me, no matter what I want to be, you've got a course for. He said, yeah. He said, what do you want to be? I said, a tramp. Shit, he's gone like that. He said, oh, what? I said, a tramp. I said, you've got a course for that, ain't you? I said, I know how to get from here down to London on a platform ticket. I said, I know that. I said, I know how to nick a chicken all the farm. But I said, I don't know how to cook it like them Boy Scouts. That on your tramps course. I can't do it. It went like a woman's, you know. All that! Get out! See? Went in that afternoon before this board, and this Snow's laughing. Soon as I was the first bloke to beat this headmaster fella. And he offered me taff. And I thought, taff, I'd never heard of it. You know, taff, what's that? He said, Mitchells and Bostons, he said, low-level daylights. He said, bags of scope of blokes like you, he said. You know, I said, low level? He said, yeah, rooftop jobs. Oh, I thought, I ain't had none of that. I thought, I'll have some of that, yeah. Yeah, all right. I said,